What motivates a man who manages REM to become active in saving our public schools? We will introduce you to Burtis Downs. She is the best professor in America and has the award to prove it. She is also our activist of the week. Matt Damon's mom, you know she's bound to chime in at some point. And of course, we will have our weekly moment of zen.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker and Dr. Jed Hopkins. Fully leaded education talk starts now. It's time to take a look at the top trending news stories in education. Number one.
Bill Gates has recently admitted that school reform might be tougher than taking on the global health crisis. Now, some people are looking at this and saying, has Bill Gates found his soul now?
Yeah.
And admitted that, you know what, the whole idea of taking on education and some of the issues that we deal with is really problematic. Is there a sincerity now that comes out? So if you take a look at the Washington Post and the story, Improving U.S. Schools Tougher Than Global Health, Gates says, you get a chance to look at it. You read it. Is this Bill Gates being humble?
You know, it's interesting. He uses an analogy to explain his frustration. He says, you know, imagine scientists coming up with a malaria vaccine. And then after they've come up with this new thing, this malaria vaccine, it gets voted down. How frustrating would that be? You know, but he says it. But in medicine, that doesn't happen.
Right.
Yeah, you know, it gets accepted. But in education.
So in other words, Gates' education reform is the new vaccine for malaria, and we just keep rejecting it because we're not smart enough to understand that we should be curing malaria, and we keep rejecting Bill Gates.
Right. But what's really telling here is the analogy itself. It's as though education involves a technological solution. A vaccine is a technological solution. Therefore, education must have a technological solution. That's a very revealing analogy.
Number two.
You might think this is the story. Arne Duncan stepped down as the Secretary of Education. However, that's not really the story.
Oh, no.
The story is the replacement. John King, formerly the Education Administrator Extraordinaire of the state of
John
New York.
King, so
John King, right?
I don't know much about him. Tell me about him.
There's a lot to know, but there's one of the things. You got to go to Jersey Jazzman's blog site and check it out because he's got a new thing here loaded with data, tons of data. But very simply, prior to becoming the lead architect of reform in New York and now the leader of the free world and American education because he's now the new Secretary of Education, right?
Right.
John King's biggest accomplishment was the number of student suspensions that he was able to produce as an administrator of a no-excuses charter school in New York. Jed, what do we know about student suspensions and learning?
Yeah, not good.
Not good, right? Time out of class does not equate to a good learning situation.
I've looked at this article, and what's really cool about it is that it actually puts hard data into the article. This is not an opinion. There are graphs in the article showing the amount of suspensions that occurred under his watch.
Right.
So the interesting thing for me is he's got to answer to this, and I'm going to be really interested to know how he responds to this.
I want to see how he's going to respond to it now too as the new Secretary of Education because you know, is this what we now are going to get? We celebrated Arne Duncan's departure.
Yes, we did.
Does this article make us want Arne to come back? Because is this what's coming, John King?
Yeah.
Is this the future? Yeah. Student suspensions, ed reform.
Watch this space.
Watch out. Talk about a diverse resume. He's an attorney by trade who manages the legendary rock band REM and is also a board member of the Network for Public Education and a parent. Welcome to Busted Pencils, Burtis Downs. Manager of REM, what was that like?
It was fun. I mean, overall, from the beginning to the end, it was fun because they're great guys. They made really good music, and I got to be kind of, you know, help them get the music out to the world, get to travel the world. We got to do a lot of pretty great stuff over the years. So if I had to come up with one word for what was it like to manage the band REM, you know, it was fun. Really was.
The front man, Michael Stipe, I mean, is he the guy with the most character, or is that just a stereotype?
Well, I don't know what you mean by the most character. No, I'd say they're tied in the amount of character they have. They're all very characterful guys, and they're all characters as well. Michael, though, there is actually an interesting educational aspect to Michael in that his sister and brother-in-law are lifelong career educators. They're teachers. And the song Sitting Still, you might remember that from their first record. It was the B-side of Radio for Europe, and it was on Murmur, and it's a great song. It's one of their, you know, kind of classic early REM stuff from back in those days. Sitting Still was about his sister who teaches deaf kids, taught deaf kids her whole career. And if you listen closely to the words of the song, of course, there weren't really many words to the song, but what you can go to the internet and get the unofficial lyrics or whatever, it's pretty clear that that song is about, and he used to do a little sign language at the end of the song, you know, which was a way of communicating with his sister who was communicating with deaf kids.
How the hell does the manager of REM end up as a public education advocate?
Well, it's not that hard. I have kids.
Okay, well.
First of all, I went to school. And second of all, I'm pretty interested in politics. Third of all, I'm pretty interested in hypocrisy in politics. And fourth of all, I had kids. And so I had kids a little later than usual. I mean, I had kids in my 40s, and I still have kids, and I'm in my 50s now, barely. So, you know, I guess I got interested in public education in particular and the issues around public education about 13 years ago, which is when my current college freshman was a kindergartner. And I pretty quickly realized that not only did I care about my kid, but I cared a lot about other kids, other people's kids. And I certainly cared about some of the changes that were going on in the testing. And, you know, I started kind of getting into it, kind of asking questions and reading and, you know, getting more and more drawn into the issues that you guys deal with every day that we all deal with every day. I've come from a parent's perspective and somebody who's pretty politically active and engaged in my community. And so, you know, I just happened to also have a job teaching at the law school and working with the band REM. I mean, it's just kind of part of my life. And in this particular part of my life, it can be a little bit more of how I spend my time because, hey, the band broke up, so I don't have as much going on with them. I mean, we're not traveling, we're not touring, we're not making records.
Right.
So, you know, I can pour a lot of my time, and I'm sort of, I guess at this point, I'm sort of actively retired. There's still some work to be done for the guys. They still are a business. We still have their legacy to look after and sort of shepherd. There's still, you know, stuff to do, but it's not nearly the intensity it was when we were touring and making records and traveling the world and doing all that stuff.
You're not just an advocate. I mean, let's specifically talk about what it is you're involved with, because now that you said you had time, the Network for Public Education and NPE.
Yeah.
You're a founding board member of that group. How'd that happen?
I was in the second wave.
Okay.
The founding board members were Diane Ravitch and Anthony, who had the idea. Anthony Cody had the idea. Anthony and Diane started the Network for Public Education. They called four or five people they knew from around the country. Phyllis Bush from Indiana, Julian Vasquez Helig from Austin and now San Antonio, Lainey Hameson, Class Lives Matters from New York City. There may have been one or two others I'm probably forgetting. Anyway, I know that there was a small founding board, and then I was on the second wave. I got a call asking me if I wanted to join that board, and I did. Of course I wanted to. They do important things. It's a really interesting national board of people that come from different perspectives. It's now headed by Carol Burris. Carol Burris is the principal of the year in New York State. She's written extensively, often in the Washington Post, probably the best stuff written from an educator's standpoint on Common Core and testing. The last two or three years has been her work. She's recently retired and become the executive director of our C3. You know, so it's a board that I feel like does some good work, can do more. We're a small organization, but we have some pretty big issues, and we're trying to come at them in pretty intelligent ways and to mobilize public opinion and mobilize activists that want to do things.
So what would you say, Burdus, is like the most pressing issues?
Well, they're all kind of wrapped up together. You know, I would say tied for me. There's a few that come to mind of like the most pressing issues in education right now. In general, getting politicians to go by that old Hippocratic oath called first do no harm. They're trying to fix things. When you're trying to fix things, better not to fix them and make them worse than they were. And right now, I feel like a lot of the putative fixes, a lot of things that are being offered as ways to improve are actually not improving. The over-testing, the absurd demands on teachers. So I think in terms of the all wrapped together issues, but teacher morale, I mean, I think that there are studies right now and statistics that show, and certainly in certain states like North Carolina and now Nevada, you know, you're hearing these massive teacher shortages where lots and lots of schools are you know, overwhelmingly being staffed by temporary workers because they can't hire teachers. Who would want to do that job at this point? You know, test proctors.
Right.
And that's tragic. What I'm finding, and I wrote the thing in the Post a couple of years ago that Valerie ran, open letter to Obama on my daughter's school in Clark Central in Athens, Georgia. And what I'm finding, everybody's all worried about, you know, bad teachers. Well, you know, not every teacher, most teachers are pretty great. And what I'm finding is that we're losing good teachers. We're losing mid-career teachers. We're losing teachers that shouldn't be retiring. But they've had enough. They can't do it anymore. They don't feel like they're doing any good for the kids. They're harming the kids.
Teacher morale. You know a lot about the importance of morale being a manager of an artistic group, right?
Sure. And teachers are motivated in different ways than business people are motivated. Teachers are motivated intrinsically. They get up in the morning wanting to affect kids positively. They want to, you know, I know teachers who went into teaching because a teacher got them on the right track, got them set in a direction of wanting to go to college and wanting to improve their lives and improve their families. And you know, these teachers want to have the same effect on the next generation, you know, 10 or 15 year younger kids. And that's been true for a long time. And right now, all the teacher evaluation, we're in Georgia, just, you know, we've got a new law. Of course, it's a race to the top law. It's all based on Barney Duncan and the race to top funding. And so now 50% of every teacher's grade, even the teachers that don't teach the tested subjects, has to be on standardized testing. And we've got a whole system of things called SLO, Student Learning Objective, S-L-O. And it involves a whole lot of testing in things like math, reading and writing, sure. But the SLOs affect the non-tested subjects like art and music and PE. Right. And it takes weeks of time at the beginning of the year and again at the end of the year. All of this time is not being spent teaching and actually doing art, music, and teaching.
What is it with the South and acronyms that don't make sense? Because you now have SLO, and a little bit north of you when I was in Virginia. Now, Virginia has the SOLs, the Standards of Learning.
Yeah, right.
Okay,
yeah,
and we all know what SOL means, too, right?
Yeah.
So Georgia, you've got SLO. In Virginia, you've got SOL. So I didn't know if that's some kind of Southern thing about throwing acronyms.
I don't plan to start a charter school, but I thought about starting one that's called the Scholastic Collegium of Applicated Muckatology, because the acronym, of course, would be SCAM, and that would be a great, great acronym for my charter.
I like it.
That'd be a perfect one. So, Bertus, I mean, I want to come back to NPE, the Network for Public Education. Advocacy group, professional organization, or how about this one, Union Front Group?
I don't think so. I mean, I think the Network for Public Education has a broad base of support and has done conferences so far in Austin and in Chicago. Next year, we're doing our one in April in Raleigh. I guess the way Diane put it is we try to go to where the fire is. Right now,
that's Diane Ravitch.
Chicago. Right. She said that in Austin, you know, we're coming here to the belly of the beast where all the testing revolution stuff started, the Texas miracle, all No Child Left Behind, which begat Race to the Top, and all the overtesting we got right now. So we were in Austin the first time. We didn't know how it was going to go. It was a grand experiment. Then last year, it almost doubled in size. So next time, it's in a very nice part of downtown Raleigh at the convention center, and we're planning on it to be a neat conference that pulls together teachers, parents, academics, private citizens, journalists, you know, students. We had a lot of kids, you saw last year, a lot of the juniors and seniors from the Newark Students Union and the Providence Student Union kids have been there over the years. So we think in Raleigh, we have one real neat highlight already to announce, which is that the keynote speaker is going to be Reverend William Barber. I don't know if you've seen him speak, but he's worth coming to the conference just to hear him.
Yes.
And I think he's speaking on Saturday morning, from what I understand, but he's committed to being there that weekend. It's the weekend of April 15, 16, 17, so it's right there in the middle of April in Raleigh. And, you know, it's drivable for a lot of the East Coast.
Right.
And no state, you know, there's a lot of states that probably have a claim on being the most savagely, undercut and diminished in their public sector in public schools. Nobody can top North Carolina right now in terms of what's gone on the last 3.5 years, next year being an election year as well. The Network for Public Education, to get back to what you were asking, we're actually a C3 and a C4.
Okay.
A C3 being a educational charitable group that tries to, you can advocate with a C3, but you do it based on issues and based on ideas. Yeah, and you're trying to get the good word out on things and, you know, let people know what's going on. And then the C4 is slightly more political in nature. There's more involved in sort of what I used to be called lobbying, now might be called government relations, can endorse, and we in fact do endorse. One of the reasons that this whole group was started was to endorse candidates, because we know that in certain parts of the country right now, there are a lot of statewide and local school board and school commission elections with lots of money flying in from out of state, from certain families and certain zip codes that seem to be keenly interested in the Atlanta public school race, or in the Perth, Amboy, New Jersey public school race, or the New Orleans, the L.A. So we try to counter that with information and with facts and with views and substantive issues. So we do try to get the word out in terms of who represents the issues we care about, which is real teaching and learning going on in real schools.
I got to say, Tim and I are both teachers and teacher educators, so we've been to thousands of conferences. The NPE conference is by far the most stimulating, inspiring.
It's you leave feeling like you've learned something, and that you can continue on, and that we are doing something.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and that there's other
people. It's a great mixture.
We have parallel universes. You know, whether it's somebody from Indiana you just met, or somebody from Florida you just met, or you realize it's not just us. It's not just us in Wisconsin. It's not just us in Georgia. It's as I've said before in some little pithy comment, it's the same fight all over. You know, it's different details. It's different characters. It's different amounts of money. It's the same fight all over. It is the same stuff.
You leave reinvigorated.
Yeah,
you do. And I appreciate you saying that. We've only done two, and the first one was a total experiment. We had no idea if it could even fly. And then the second one, we just wanted to top the first one, and I think we did. So we're hoping that Raleigh will be the best one yet. Anybody listening that's at all interested in education, I think it's also, we haven't set the exact price, but I think last year the early bird special price to sign up for was $75. We keep it low. We keep it as cost effective as we can. We do it in hotels that are not overly expensive. We don't have any frills. There's no, you know, it's not a lot of bells and whistles. What you get is, I think it's about 40 panels, unfortunately, like six at a time, so you have to make choices. But you have, between the keynoters and the informal working groups and the networking, all that kind of stuff. And then these panels where you get to go and decide what is it you're interested in most hearing about that hour, you really do walk away from there both substantively and, as you said, kind of energized, engaged. And I felt that way both times too. So I appreciate you saying that.
Where does your funding, where does the network's funding come from?
The network public education funding comes from all over. I mean, it comes from, I've given money to it. Other individuals give money to it. Teachers give money to it. Conference attendees give money to it. Teachers' unions give money to it. We get grants from family foundations. We get grants from individuals. We get grants from general foundations. We don't get any grants from the Gates Foundation, as far as I know. In fact, I'm pretty sure we don't.
And surprise,
nor the DeVos, nor the Walton. There are quite a few that don't give us money, but you know, there are some that give in smaller doses. I think we have a pretty wide variety of funding sources.
Bertus, I do know this little secret that we can end with. So you were just at a two-day retreat with all of the board members of the Network for Public Education. Any top secret plans you want to reveal?
Yes, at an undisclosed location.
Bertus Downs, manager of REM, public school advocate and founding board member of the Network for Public Education. Bertus, thank you for being on Busted Pencils, Fully Leaded Education Talk Radio. We hope we can talk to you again sometime soon.
Absolutely. Thanks very much for having me, and I really appreciate all the good work, getting the good word out.
Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils.
She's a board member of United Opt Out, a founding member of the Badass Teachers, and BAMI's recently named Best Professor in America. She lives, eats, breathes education activism, and that is why she is our Activist of the Week. Welcome to Busted Pencils, Denisha Jones. Denisha, what made you decide to be an activist as opposed to just a teacher?
Well, Tim, I found it really hard to do my job once I finally became a teacher because the job that I wanted since I was a little girl was not what I thought it was going to be. And I had two options. I could stay and fight for the job I wanted, or I could leave this profession altogether. And so after my first year of teaching kindergarten, when I was forced to treat five-year-olds like they needed to be obedient little people and prepare them for practice tests that would be practice tests for practice tests, I just said I can't do that. But I wasn't ready to give up on my profession. I wanted to be a teacher since I was 10 years old. I loved going to school. I loved learning. I loved teaching, and I didn't want to give up. So the only way I could still keep doing what I was doing was to become an activist, and that's what I did.
Tell me about this organization called BAT.
BAT stands for the Badass Teachers Association.
Did you just say a bad word? Did you just say a bad ass?
I did say badass. And so together, it may or may not be a bad word, depending on what generation from you're from.
Okay, so BATs are badass teachers.
Started a couple years ago. There was a group called the Badass Parents Association, and people were on social media like, haha, we should start a Badass Teachers Association and we should see what happened. Well, no one could have believed what happened. We had so many members. People flocked to it. It grew. It was one of the fastest social media organizations that I saw grow in that short amount of time. And so I was fortunate to jump in on the ground floor when there was just a couple hundred of us, and then to stay a part of it, which is now over 55,000 people. And so it's been a really amazing place. But what we learned is that teachers want it to be badass. They want it to feel like they were not going to stand back and just let all these reforms happen to them. And they wanted a place where they can go and say, you know, this is crazy. What can we do? And so it's part advocacy, part keeping your sanity through some fellowship, and part activism.
There's another phenomena that you're associated with, too. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that. And that is the opt-out movement, right?
Yes. And actually, I became associated with the opt-out movement first. So in 2011, I moved back to Washington, D.C., and that was the year that the Save Our Schools planned their huge rally, really set up with what was happening in education. We had thousands of people come. We had Matt Damon speak, which was amazing. I volunteered at that event to kind of help out, and that's where I met a lot of the people who formed United Opt Out. United Opt Out formed, and they wanted to do this Occupy the Department of Education, and so I lived in Washington, D.C., so of course I went. And what I quickly learned, if you keep showing up to these United Opt Out events, they will quickly make you part of the group. So I went to their first Occupy the Department event. I went to Occupy 2.0. I went to their event in Denver, and they were like, you know what, we want you. So I was fortunate to be invited to be an admin for that group, and we're working with them. It's really awesome, because although I don't have children to opt out and I don't administer tests, I know that this is one strategy in fighting all of these corporate reforms. So I use my voice in higher ed to kind of go out and talk to people about what it means to opt out and why they should be doing it.
But your primary responsibility is a professor of early childhood education. Talk about, you know, how these organizations and your view of activism work in tandem, or is it a conflict sometimes being a professor?
I'm fortunate. I think it could be a conflict depending on where you worked. I'm a professor at Howard University, and my dean, Dr. Leslie Fenwick, is really supportive of all this activism, which I wasn't sure at first. You know, I was trying to keep everything on the hush-hush, like, let's just keep these lives separate. And she came to me when she saw that I was a listed speaker for Occupy 2.0, and she was so thrilled because somebody from Howard was a part of that. And so I then realized I don't have to keep this on the hush-hush because my dean's very supportive. My department is supportive to the point where they're happy someone is doing it. You know, not everybody wants to be in activism, but right. They want our students to get to know someone who is. So my chair is like, you're doing that. You're giving the students that view, and that's great. Part of our mission at the Howard University School of Education is to develop change agents. I'm teaching to the mission of our school.
All this work has resulted this year in the fact that you have won Best Professor, a BAMMY.
Yeah, it's really an honor. I still can't believe that I won. So there's a group called the Academy of Education, Arts, and Sciences, and they get together, and they want to kind of get, you know, in the public perception, education is always attacked, right? We're always doing something wrong. On the 6 o'clock news, you only hear about education if someone brings a gun to school or if, you know, a teacher does something wrong with a student. You never hear about the good things. So this group works to really highlight what's working in education. And their members then nominate people for an award in all different sectors, right? Principals, assistant teachers, broken down by topic, like early childhood directors. So policy people, they look at the whole gamut of the field of education and then nominate folks. And I was really fortunate. Susan Oshorn, who you might know from the Early Childhood Policy Network group, nominated me for an award. Then, yeah, they made the announcement and I won. And I was just surprised. I don't think it's for activism, of course. It's for being a college professor, which I am. But I spent so much time being in activism that technically, I'm not a good college professor. Like, I'm behind on my publications because I'm so busy going to rallies and going to conferences, and I'd rather be talking to teachers and students and parents. So that was kind of really surprising. So I believe it was my activism family, as I call them, is the reason why I was able to win that.
You know, Denisha, I just want to say, you've shown us how to bust pencils. You are still busting pencils. Denisha, carry on busting those pencils.
This is Matt Damon on Busted Pencils Radio. Please stop bothering me and just ask my mom already.
I'm all for her. Activist of the Week. I'm sure she's a terrific professor, but she's also an activist. And this is why she's perfect for Activist of the Week, because she's an educator and she's an amazing education activist. She's doing so many things to try to move the needle towards, you know, greater justice in education. She's one of those rare people who understands the big picture and the issues of racial and economic and social injustice and how they play out in education. So I can imagine the people learning from her in her education sphere are probably very affected by her consciousness about all these things. She's also extending her reach far beyond the classroom by all these activist organization she's part of, and it's not just that her name's there. She's really working on these issues.
This week's Moment of Zen features none other than Howard himself speaking about the purpose of history.
We want our history, whatever period it deals with and whatever the words are, we want them to be aimed at us. And we want them to provoke us and stimulate us and inspire us to participate in the social struggles of our time. That's our aim.
Hear past episodes of Busted Pencils, read our blogs, and keep up with trending news anytime and all the time at bustedpencils.com. Also, follow us on Twitter and Facebook. On our next show, we will introduce you to the BATS, Bad-Ass Teachers. For Jed Hopkins, I'm Tim Slucker. Thanks for busting pencils.